Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program, coming to you today live from Chicago, Illinois, right here at O'Hare Airport. It is a spectacular day here in the Windy City, and I've been here for a series of meetings. Glad to be talking to you today, and the topic of our conversation today is going to be, for the main segment of the program, this ridiculous decision from the Colorado Supreme Court throwing out a death penalty sentence simply because the jurors consulted a Bible, of all things, consulted a Bible for moral guidance in understanding the death penalty in the sentencing phase of that particular trial. We're going to be talking about that. Some of you have been reading about it, no doubt. But with everything else happening in the world, we've had to delay a few days our conversation. But it's too important to miss. I want you to get ready to call us. Join the conversation at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Of course, two big world events that are getting a lot of media attention right now. The Pope's funeral mass this morning was held in St. Peter's Square, called together one of the largest crowds in the history of funerals, you might say, certainly in terms of the history of the papacy. And the gathering of dignitaries was immense. And we've been talking about the papacy, about John Paul II and all that. It now comes to an end with the formal ceremonies, his body now interred in the crypt of St. Peter's Basilica. It's been a fascinating thing to watch, and we've had a lot of really substantial conversation about the Pope, the papacy, and all the issues related to this. Tomorrow, the long-delayed marriage of Prince Charles and Lady Camilla Parker Bowles takes place. Long-delayed, that's what one of the media reports this morning said. How long was it delayed? One day. I guess that's all a matter of interpretation. But just think about what this means. Now, I mentioned on this program last week that at least some of the more conservative members of the clergy in the Church of England were demanding that if there was to be any church blessing of this union, remember, because both of the parties here, both Prince Charles and Camilla Parker Bowles, are divorced, and in the case of Camilla Parker Bowles, her former husband is still living, the Church of England will not allow the marriage to take place within the church as a church wedding. But it is going to hold some kind of blessing ceremony thereafter, and some conservative priests in the Church of England were demanding that Prince Charles and Camilla Parker Bowles, who have been involved in an adulterous relationship going all the way back to when both were married, that they must repent of their sins in a public way. And in fact, one was going so far as to say that he would do his best to obstruct the wedding if Prince Charles did not apologize to Camilla Parker Bowles' former husband. But now it was released this morning that the prince and his new bride are going to admit, quote, their wickedness, end quote, in the course of their adultery. Now, I don't know how explicit it's going to be. I just want to say some word of commendation to the priests in the Church of England who were holding fast to the fact that something had to take place to acknowledge the sin of adultery when it came to Prince Charles and his new bride. But, folks, this is just another example of what has happened in our postmodern age to the very idea of royalty as upholding a moral example. What kind of moral example comes out of this? It was said back when Prince Charles and Lady Diana were married that it was a fairy tale come true. Well, you can hardly say that about this. I can remember when I was a kid, there was a cartoon series called Fractured Fairy Tales. If ever there was a fractured fairy tale, it is this. And there'll be a lot of people watching it nonetheless. I tell you one little humorous anecdote about all this. One angle is that because of the Pope's funeral, they had to delay the wedding a day. And if you know anything about the British monarchy, you know that there is an entire industry of souvenir makers that thrives on the monarchy. They sell all kinds of knickknacks and scarves and mugs and pins and all the rest, and any kind of royal occasion becomes an opportunity for merchandising the monarchy. Well, guess what? All of them have the wrong date because they had to delay the wedding for one day. Some of us will find some delicious irony in that. On to more important issues, and certainly in terms of our own domestic affairs, I want to alert you to the fact that that Democratic senators in Washington are doing their very best to stall two of President Bush's appointees for a couple of the most critical positions in the United States government. In particular, they are trying to delay or to prevent the confirmation of John Bolton to be the United States Ambassador to the United Nations and the appointment of Dr. Lester Crawford to be the Commissioner for the Food and Drug Administration. And both of these men not only deserve to be confirmed, but we desperately need for them to be confirmed. What is the complaint against John Bolton? It is that no one who is a critic of the United Nations should become the UN ambassador. That's exactly the wrong mentality. If anything, we need a severe critic of the United Nations to be the United States representative before that body. John Bolton would be in a very prestigious and esteemed line of those who have been critics who have represented the United States in the United Nations. I think in particular of Jean Kirkpatrick, who was the United Nations ambassador under President Ronald Reagan. What we need is someone who understands the temptations, the waywardness, the leftist direction, the moral imbecility of the United Nations, and is willing to call it what it is. We need to encourage the United States Senate to confirm John Bolton as United Nations ambassador, and we need to get him there as quickly as possible. The same thing is true for Dr. Lester Crawford. Why are Democratic senators, those on the left, now opposing him to be the commissioner for the Food and Drug Administration? It is because he will not tell them in his confirmation hearings that he will allow and certify the morning after pill for over-the-counter sales. And in particular, Senators Hillary Rodham Clinton and Patty Murray are pushing Dr. Crawford in saying that if he does not promise that he will approve over-the-counter sales the morning after pill, he will not receive the confirmation he needs to head the Food and Drug Administration. Folks, here we have the sex issues all over the place. Reproduction, contraception, and in this case, abortion, because what we're talking about, the morning after pill, is a pill that would not allow a fertilized egg to implant itself in the lining of the uterus. It's just an abortion by a different name. And, you know, I would be appalled to think that President Bush would appoint someone who would approve this for over-the-counter sales. Just last week, we were also talking about the New York Times going after pharmacists who, driven by their own conscience and pro-life convictions, would not distribute the morning-after pill. And, of course, the New York Times is calling for that to be made illegal as well. There is still time for you to write your senator, go to the email, make your convictions known. We need to get Ambassador Bolton confirmed and Lester Crawford confirmed as head of the Food and Drug Administration. Well, we've been talking about biomedical ethics and reproductive ethics recurringly because these are some of the front page issues of our time. And now the Boston Globe has released a story saying that experts are debating the age limits for assisted childbearing. That is, for childbearing that would have to do with in vitro fertilization and similar technologies. The Ethics Committee of the Infertility Service at Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital is involved in a debate about this. The question, when is a woman simply too old to become a mother? You'll remember on this program we talked about a 66-year-old Romanian Adriana Iliescu, who gave birth to a 3.2-pound baby girl. We talked about how the press missed so many of these issues, how several fertilized eggs were developed, several embryos came to life, and yet only this one survived, this underweight. And this woman was 66 years old. She'll be 80 years old when the daughter's supposed to be a freshman in high school. Listen to this, though. Alice Domar, a psychologist and director of the Mind-Body Center for Women's Health at Boston IVF, that's the country's biggest fertility clinic, said this. Now, she said two statements. I want you to hear them both. Number one, she said, there is a basic right to procreation. Consider that for a moment. Secondly, she said, I think every child born into this world deserves to have its mother see it into adulthood. Now, folks, you can't believe that the world is round and that the world is flat. You can't believe that 2 plus 2 equals 4 and that 2 plus 2 equals 5. This is a ridiculous collision of two statements. You can't say there is a basic right to procreation and then say every child born into this world deserves to have its mother see it into adulthood. This idea that there's a basic right to procreate is one of the most fallacious and dangerous ideas now set loose in our culture today. John Robertson of the University of Texas at Austin calls this procreative liberty, saying that enshrined within the Bill of Rights, so far as he would claim, there is a basic human right to procreate. Irregardless of without regard, I should say, to marriage, to any state, to age, to health, or to anything else, just a basic right to procreate. Well, Alice Domar says she believes in that as well, but then she comes back and she says, I think every child born into this world deserves to have its mother see it into adulthood. Well, she doesn't believe in an unconditional right to procreate. That is the issue. And what we have here are two different competing ideals in our postmodern age, and they are colliding head-on. One is the claim that everything is a matter of individual liberty, and the other is the claim, which I think most of us who are sane human beings would recognize, that a child needs a parent. And in this case, a child needs a mother. Now, what we are fighting against in this age of high technology and biomedical breakthroughs is the idea that there are certain age limits to experiences and to resources, even in human life. And when it comes to pregnancy, you know, it's amazing, isn't it? God seems to have put a timer within the human body. There is an age for childbearing. And if you go far beyond that age, you bring on unintended medical consequences and all kinds of ethical quandaries. But the kind of statement that I just read to you, the two twin statements made by Alice Domar, indicate something of the collision of values in this culture, and that's why we need to think through these things carefully as Christians. We need to look at them, take them apart, not just consider what the press has to say, not just listen to the cultural conversation, but consider the worldview issues at stake. Now, I think you would call that an intelligent Christian conversation. And that's what we're about day by day. And now we're going to be looking at the decision by the Colorado Supreme Court throwing out a death penalty sentence simply because jurors consulted the Bible. We're going to figure that out in just a minute. Join the conversation. I'm Albert Mohler. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler program. Just when you think you have seen the extent of the kind of ridiculous decisions handed down by courts and you think it can't get any worse, you're surprised when actually something worse comes along. And in this case, it comes from Colorado, where the Colorado Supreme Court has upheld a lower court's decision that reversed the sentence of a murderer who had been given the death penalty. The reason? Jurors were found to have consulted the Bible in reaching their decision. Now, there are interesting twists and turns in this story, but right now, we see the issues of secularism, legal principles, moral reasoning all coming into conflict. And it is a slim majority on Colorado's High Court that came to this decision. It was a 3-2 decision. Now, what really happened here is becoming more and more clear. Robert Harlan was convicted of kidnapping a waitress named Rhonda Maloney. He later raped and murdered her. At some point in the commission of his crime, Maloney escaped and caught the attention of a passing motorist, Jackie Criazzo. Eventually, Robert Harlan shot Criazzo as well, left her paralyzed. Only after that did he murder Maloney in an act of extreme violence and brutality. Now, in his trial, he received all the proper protections. He had an adequate defense, but he was convicted. And in the penalty phase of his trial, in just short order, the jurors came back with a death sentence, which they recommended to the court. Now, according to Colorado law, jurors during the sentencing phase of a capital trial are to take several factors into consideration, but one of the things that they are specifically assigned in Colorado, and this is unique to Colorado, is that each juror is to make what is called an individual moral assessment of the death penalty and of the circumstances in this case. Now, this jury had been sequestered, that is, that legally they had been in a protected environment. They were not allowed to see the media in terms of any coverage of legal issues, this trial or any other trial. They were cut off from contact with their own family, lest they discuss the trial. When they were talking to a family member, an agent of the court had to be present. They did not have cell phones. They didn't have land phones. They didn't have radios. They didn't have newspapers. But one thing was not considered. The Bibles were left in the hotel rooms. And at least one juror consulted a Bible, another consulted a Bible, and the concordance to the Bible. By the way, the court calls it an index, doesn't even know what a concordance is. And one juror made notes out of the Bible. Now remember, the court told them to make an individual moral assessment about the death penalty and about the circumstances of this trial and of this particular crime and bringing the recommendation. Now one juror looked in Leviticus, where it said that he who kills shall be put to death. Another looked to Romans 13. Verse 1, which says that citizens are to obey rightful authorities, and in this case, the rightfully constituted government. Well, the jurors considered this, and at least a couple of the jurors, in making their individual moral assessment about the circumstances of this crime and the nature of the death penalty, decided that those biblical principles did indeed pertain to their decision-making in recommending the death penalty. Just a few months after the death penalty was handed down, an investigator for Mr. Harlan's attorneys interviewed some of those who had been on the jury and heard about the use of the Bible. They immediately petitioned to the court to reverse the death penalty because of the illegal, unconstitutional, and unsubstantiated, ungrounded use of the Bible in this moral decision-making, and the trial court eventually threw out the death penalty. It was appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court, and by the way, it may be appealed still further. The state of Colorado has the right to appeal this on up to the federal courts. It remains to be seen whether they will do so. But the reasoning of Colorado's High Court is absolutely insidious. They speak about the use of the Bible as if it was bringing into the deliberation process some kind of extraneous moral authority. They went on and they said that because of this, they could no longer say that Mr. Harlan had his constitutional rights protected and that the decision about the death penalty did not involve prejudice and passion brought in by external influences such as the Bible. So in a 3-2 decision on March 28th, the Supreme Court of the state of Colorado threw out the death sentence, saying that they can no longer say that this sentence was not influenced by passion, prejudice, or some other arbitrary factor. That's an exact quote. Folks, I've read this decision, handed down by the court from top to bottom. I've looked at every single word of it, and the closer you look at it, the more angry you will get. Now, let's just consider a couple of facts here. When persons are customarily sworn into testimony as a witness in a criminal trial in this country, what do? They put their hand on the Bible, they swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Anyone ready to complain about that? If they don't want to put their hand on the Bible, they can do so just on their own personal name, but the Bible's there. Now, get this. In his argument before the jury, pleading for his defendant's life just as the penalty phase of the trial was in process, Mr. Harlan's defense attorney actually cited the Bible. Now, he did so in a weird, bizarre, and completely unsubstantiated, irrational way. Frankly, he went to the story of Abraham and Isaac, and he said since God had given Abraham mercy, even as he had been prepared to kill his own son, so also this jury should extend to Mr. Harlan mercy. Well, that isn't the point of that passage from Genesis at all, having to do with Abraham, but let's just skip that for a moment and consider that it was considered constitutional for the defense to say, here's a Bible mandate for mercy, you need to consider it, but it is then unconstitutional for jurors to consult the Bible about the death penalty? Now, a couple of other little interesting facts about this we need to put into play before we open the phone lines. Number one, if there had not been a physical Bible in the room, according to the court's minority, this would have been beyond question. In other words, these jurors would have had the right to remember Bible verses. They just couldn't bring in a Bible. One other aspect of all this, the use of the Bible was explicitly cited as a cause of prejudice and passion. What does this say about the ability of jurors? This is supposed to be a citizen-based form of justice. What does this say about the personal convictions of jurors? Are you now unable to have a conscience established by biblical convictions in order to serve on a jury? I want to know what you think about this. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. See, I think what this will lead to is not only a separation of the Bible from moral decision-making in the Colorado courts, I think it's just one more step towards saying that those who have deep Christian convictions really can't serve without prejudice and passion on juries. That is no incredible leap of logic. Just consider the logic that is embedded in this decision from the Supreme Court. Now, what attorney is going to come next to say, I believe this person on the jury was a Christian and therefore believes in the Bible, and the Bible teaches this. Therefore, we can't say that that person made an individual moral assessment without prejudice or passion or some form of arbitrary influence. I think this is very troubling. And furthermore, we wouldn't be talking about this if this appeared just to be some kind of isolated development that was disconnected from what's happening in other states and other courts. I think this is just one more indication of the general trajectory of the courts. I want to know what you think. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Rob. Rob, welcome to the Albert Mueller Program.
Just that if we cannot cite the Bible, then any moral or civil law that is based upon the Bible.
All right, we lost Rob there, but the point is that if we cannot cite the Bible in moral decision-making, what can we cite? And if not citing the Bible is a constitutional necessity, what does that say about the freedom of religion in the United States? What does it say about the moral conscience of American citizens? Folks, we're in big trouble. I want you to join the conversation. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Today, live from Chicago, Illinois, we're talking about a case from Colorado, but it could just as easily be your state. It could be the Supreme Court where you live. It could be even a lower court making a similar decision. You know how courts cite each other. Legal precedents become dangerous things embedded in the law and embedded in legal habit. Before you know it, this is going to be something that, if unchecked, will spread all across the country. Give me a call. Join the conversation, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Colorado now. What state next? I'll be right back.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, the Bible does have a lot to say about law. It has a lot to say about right and wrong. It has a lot to say about penalties, even about the death penalty. Does that mean that it's now unconstitutional to use that in argument? You know, it's not just the Bible. You can go all the way back to the Code of Hammurabi, ancient law codes that talk about this as well. Is it some kind of constitutional violation to talk about that? You know, you just have to wonder where this is going to lead. We've got our call system up, folks. I want you to give me a call and join the conversation. 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We had Rob. We're going to go back to him here. Call him from Colorado. Rob, go right ahead.
Yeah, if we're not able to use the cite the Bible, then any civil or moral law, which is based upon what the Bible says, is null and void. So apparently then we're violating his rights by simply saying that murder is wrong, which begs the next question, aren't our rights given to us by God?
Well, you would think so, Rob. And as a matter of fact, the Declaration of Independence seems to think so. And I'd like to know where they would come from otherwise. Rob, you said that murder is wrong. You made quite a radical statement there. Let me come back to you. Why is murder wrong? How do we know that?
Well, if we can't use the Bible, we don't. If there's no moral standard, then murder is simply a choice.
Yeah, you know, if you have to take any kind of transcendent moral authority out of this, about the most we can say is that murder is messy and inconvenient. I mean, there's no real right and wrong to it. You make a very good point, Rob, and I think what you're pointing to here is the fact that if you undercut the moral nature of the law as transcending the law itself, we're in big trouble. If you reject that, if you say the law just has to be what it is, if murder's wrong because the law says it's wrong, that is the civil law, the criminal law, just human law, then we can negotiate that away. And I guess that's what we're seeing, aren't we? Thanks for your call, Rob. Let's go to Dale calling from Houston, Texas, listening on XM Satellite Radio. Dale, go right ahead.
Yes, I agree with what Rob was saying, that the law of the land cannot just stand on its merits alone. It had an origination from the Word of God. I mean, the Ten Commandments was the basis of all law. And I can't see how one would think that it doesn't have any bearing. If things didn't offend us or somehow affect our morality, then it wouldn't be an issue. As he stated, you know, you go around killing everybody, it wouldn't even matter. But because God's law said, thou shalt not kill, God's law, supreme law, anything that any man or whatever could do would just be an additional thing. So I believe...
Sorry to cut you off there, but I think that's exactly what we're facing. I think we're looking at a collision between those who believe that the law has to be based on some transcendent moral authority and those who think that the law just stands on its own. That last position, by the way, is known as legal positivism. It simply says that the law is what the law says it is. There's no higher morality. Whatever the law declares is moral, that's what's moral. Whatever the law declares is immoral, that is immoral. Then you tie legality to the same construct. But, you know, when you're talking about the law, you know, most people, I think, when they hear the law, think of the criminal law, the civil law, the body of law adopted by a people, by a state. But, you know, there has to be some law beyond that law. America just didn't decide recently that murder's wrong. We inherited a legal tradition on a moral understanding. Where did that come from? English common law. Where did that come from? Christian conviction based upon the Bible. That's where it came from. Now, we are told in Romans chapter 1 that God's even written his law on the human heart so that all of us should have, even in our conscience, an innate understanding of the wrongness of sin, and in particular the wrongness of an act like murder. But, you know, without some transcendent authority behind the law, all you're left with is the fact you can say, well, the law says murder's illegal. You really can't say murder's wrong. You can't say it's immoral. You can't say it's just categorically evil. What does this say about the rights of a citizen? You know, how would you serve on a jury if you're effectively told you can't have a Bible? You may be a Christian. The Bible may be how you form your, quote, individual moral assessment that's called for by the court in a sentencing phase of a death penalty case. Are you supposed to be a Christian until you walk into a jury room? What if one juror says to the other, you know, I think human life is sacred because we're made in God's image, and I think the Bible makes very clear that murder is inherently wrong and should be answered with a death penalty when it is a wanton act of violence that takes the life of another human being. Now, does that mean you throw out the whole case? Well, this court did not go that far, but the logic is right there. What this court said is that having the physical presence of a printed Bible used in this deliberation is enough to prejudice the jury process against this defendant. He must be laughing all the way to his life sentence. Just think about this. They heard through interviews that at least two jurors had brought Bibles into the deliberation process. And something tells me that the attorneys on the other side thought, you know, this is a juicy little tidbit we can turn into a reversal of the death penalty. And it worked. That's the scary thing about it. It worked. I want to know what you think about it. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. From Chicago, Illinois, this is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. We're talking about this decision out of the Colorado Supreme Court that has invalidated a death penalty sentence for a murderer simply because two of the jurors were found to have consulted Bibles in the course of the penalty phase of the jury process. Now, I mentioned the fact that they said that the use of the written word was the particular issue here. They acknowledged that the court instructed these jurors two things in particular. Number one, they were to make an individual moral assessment about the death penalty and the particulars of this crime, and they were to rely only on the data from the trial in terms of understanding the facts of the case. Well, does that have anything to do with consulting the Bible in making that individual moral assessment? Does that render it invalid, unconstitutional? Now, let me read to you from the actual decision of the majority on the court why the Bible itself in its written form was the problem. Quote, the written word persuasively conveys the authentic ring of reliable authority in a way that recollected spoken word does not. Some jurors may view biblical texts like the Leviticus passage at issue here as a factual representation of God's will. The text may also be viewed as a legal instruction issuing from God requiring a particular mandatory punishment for murder. I'm still quoting from the decision. Such a fact, they put the word facts in quotation marks, is not one presented in evidence in this case, and such a legal instruction is not the law of the state or a part of the court's instructions, end quote. End quote. Now, just think about that. Where does the logic of this lead? It leads to a totally sanitized public square. It leads to a totally secularized legal system. And I think it leads to the point where those who are convictional Christians, Bible-based in their worldview, could eventually even be excluded from juries, or you could see sentences reversed simply on the fact that there was a Christian operating out of Christian conviction in the jury process. How far we are from that, I don't know, but it's a scary thought. Let's go to Paul, calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Welcome to the Albert Mueller Program.
God bless you, Dr. Mueller. It seems to me that the law is being completely set aside in favor for a new law, which basically has no law, and yet, to me, that argument is absurd and self-defeating. Can you give me any kind of a heads up or respond to that, please?
Yeah, Paul, I tell you, I understand exactly where you're going, but I think there's a logic to what this court said. Now, I think it's entirely wrong, obviously. I oppose this with every part of my being, but I think I understand the logic. The logic is that they are operating under the illusion that you can come up with an individual moral assessment about a great moral issue like the death penalty without consulting any transcendent authority beyond the law itself. Because that's exactly what is written into the warp and the woof, the fabric of this decision handed down by a three-person majority on the Colorado High Court. They said that the Bible was an extraneous authority that was brought in, but they were charged, the jurors were charged to make a moral assessment. Now, that means that this court obviously believes that that moral assessment should have been made without consulting the Bible. That is the clearest point I can say here, Paul. They believe and have now made it the law of the state of Colorado, unless this is overturned by a federal court. They have now argued that that individual moral assessment should have been made without consulting the Bible. And I guess that just means you look within yourself into the great moral, you know, wealth of wisdom in every single human being that's supposedly here, into a secular source. Now, it does raise all kinds of interesting possibilities. What if this hadn't been the Bible, but it had been some other kind of sacred text, or some other kind of, I say sacred text, that is considered by those who would claim it, or by some other historic writing or authorities? Interesting point. Paul, this is a perverse logic, but sadly and strangely enough, it does have a logic. Let's go to Aaron, also calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Aaron, go right ahead.
Good afternoon, Dr. Mueller. Actually, I wanted to agree with a previous caller who was talking about how, you know, this basically the court is taking the law and making it devoid of its moral source. It reminds me a lot of what the Jewish scholars and the priesthood did in the pre-Christian era and divorced the law from God's original intent and basically set up their own code, which led to all the abuses that we see mentioned in the Gospels.
You had every man doing what is right in his own sight in the rebellion of Korah in the Old Testament. And I think that applies here, too, because basically I go back to that phrase right out of the criminal code of the state of Colorado, which instructs jurors that they are to make an individual moral assessment in considering whether or not the death penalty is the appropriate sentence for capital murder. Well, the very fact that Colorado, unlike most other states, it may be the only state that does this for all I know, but it is certainly unique in a general sense in requiring this, quote, individual moral assessment, end quote. Where do they think the jurors are going to be able to get the moral reasoning in order to make that assessment? They're clearly saying it's not going to come from some transcendent authority. You can't bring in the Bible. And I also wonder what would have happened had these jurors not spoken to each other about this. But, you know, isn't that what the jury process is supposed to be about, as jurors consult with each other and even debate these cases? Isn't that what the jury process is supposed to produce as a context of argument, give and take, consideration of all the evidence and the issues at stake? I think this kind of decision undermines not only the authority of the courts and the credibility of justice, but our confidence in the legal system. Here you have a murderer who committed an awful, brutal murder. And also left another woman paralyzed who was given the death sentence unanimously by a jury of his peers. And that's been reversed by the court simply because jurors consulted the Bible in the sentencing process. Let's go to Frank calling from Winter Haven, Florida. Frank's good to have you.
Hey, thank you. I was just wondering if they even had the Bible for everyone to swear into.
Yeah, you know, Frank, I mentioned that. I wonder if that's soon going to be rendered unconstitutional as well. You know, the Bible didn't enter this process only at the end. It was there at the beginning, and it was not only there, I presume, in the swearing-in process, as customary in most courts, but it was also there in terms of the explicit arguments being made by the defense counsel in this case. Mr. Harlan's own attorney made an appeal to the Bible in his argument against the death penalty, arguing from and I would say in a weird way, from a biblical text, that Mr. Harlan should be given mercy. How is it constitutional that attorney can bring in the Bible at that point, but jurors can't consult the Bible at the other point? By the way, the majority in the court said it was because that particular text was not brought in. That is from Leviticus or from Romans chapter 13. They were not entered into evidence, therefore they can't be considered. This is weird. You know, just as if there were not some great moral issue here at stake, you just think this is eccentric and weird and irrational. But there are serious moral issues at stake here. This is a legal precedent that, if left unchecked and uncorrected, would further secularize the entire legal process and try to sever the authority of the courts and the authority of the law from any transcendent authority whatsoever. That is the general trajectory of jurisprudence in America today. That's the way so many of these courts have been pushing a secularist agenda. But this case from Colorado comes with some unique twists that really bring to light some of the most, I think, frightening aspects of what this new secular shape would look like. I'll be back with some final thoughts. Live today from Chicago, Illinois, I'm Albert Moeller. Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. You know, there is never a shortage of issues to talk about. It seems that every day's newspaper and news report comes with more issues that demand our attention than could be imagined. And I think one of the dangers in all of this is a form of fatigue. I think there are a lot of Christians who simply get tired of trying to think through all these issues. And that is exactly the wrong response. What we need to do is redouble our effort to awaken the church to deal with these issues head on. And we need to learn how to be thinking Christians, to look beneath the surface of these issues and to ask the fundamental questions. Take this Colorado case, for example. It's not just the physical presence of the Bible that was at issue in this case. It's the larger question of what does this say about the nature of the law? What does this say about the authority of the courts? this just assumes a kind of legal positivism that means that the law says what is moral, and simply because the law says it, that's it. Simply because some humanly devised law makes the declaration, that's all we can say. Individual moral reasoning, individual moral assessment and analysis has to be based simply upon that secular just projection and declaration of the law. I think most of us recognize immediately that's just not enough. That's not going to work. You know, as offended as I am by this decision from the Colorado Supreme Court, I also have to say that I think that the very decision that this majority handed down puts this court in an impossible bind, because they did not throw out the necessity of jurors to be instructed to come to an individual moral assessment about the death penalty. They just said that you can't bring a Bible into this process. Well, then how exactly do these jurists on the Colorado Supreme Court think that jurors are going to be able to come up with an individual moral assessment? What kind of scrutiny is now going to be given to these jurors? What kind of interviews will now come after a death penalty imposition? What kind of things do these jurors have to watch lest they say? What if they had a Christian thought? What if they remembered a Bible verse? What if they remembered something they had been taught by their parents in terms of morality? What if they explicitly say, I based my decision upon the fact that I believe that human beings are made in the image of God, and thus, as Genesis 9:6 says, those who take a human life forfeit their own life. Wow, that looks like grounds for a reversal, for an appeal. And I think it is a pattern of secularization in terms of legal reasoning and the decision-making of this court, that if left unchecked means that it's Colorado today, it could be your state tomorrow. And not only that, it could also creep right up to the federal level. We're looking at all kinds of issues that are spinning around this one decision. It's a reminder to us, is it not, of how important it is to get the right judges in place. This is a reminder to us of why those judges nominated by President Bush deserve our support, and why we need to get on our senators to confirm these judges as quickly as possible. That'll keep us busy. I'll be back next week from Louisville, Kentucky for 5 days, Monday through Friday. We're going to have a great conversation about important issues next week. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. Thanks for joining us today. I'll meet you next week.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows, Dr. Moeller's daily crosswalk commentary, and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.